3. Get Shorty. Nicola Gobbo. Law graduate and spy. 1997 to 1999. Gobbo's first boss recalls the late 1990s sweetly. He chats to Dowsley and Carline in a cafe in Melbourne's legal district, next door to the building he's about to put up for sale for around $26 million. Not that he boasts about his wealth. Parts of his story have been suppressed, along with his name. But let's call him Levi Diamond. If he is ever cast in a movie, Danny DeVito should be the first call, despite Diamond's own view that DeVito is too short. Diamond wears a short-sleeved shirt and striped tie. He sports bags under his eyes, his wrinkles offset by his mailbox-slit smile. He speaks of his employees like a shepherd discussing his flock. There is a twinkle about him, a kind of weary wisdom fed by decades as a criminal defense lawyer. A scholar of human nature, he's been shot at and stabbed, had his home firebombed, and been attacked by a woman with a baseball bat. Twice, Diamond was suspended from practice. Twice, he was reinstated. His clients have included some of the most charismatic shitbags in modern Australian criminal history. Aspiring drug baron Tony Mockbell was a regular in his office, along with his creepy brother Horty. John Higgs was here too. Higgs had set up his own bikie branch with a sideline in drug importation. Gobbo met these criminals for the first time in Diamond's office from 1997 onwards. Her friends and Farrago co-editors had arranged her first acquaintance with Diamond. They knew him through Jewish circles and suggested she meet with him to discuss career options. Gobbo was bored with the commercial bent of her articled clerk employment. Diamond did real estate and criminal law, which sounded more enticing. When they sat down, Diamond twigged to her surname and legal heritage. Her drug possession case came up during the chat, but Diamond dismissed it as a typical tale of a university kid being busted for low-level offences. I rang him, made a time to see him, and literally went there thinking he might have some suggestions on where to go, and he offered me a job on the spot, she would later recall. The initial arrangement was a one-month trial, yet Gobbo impressed him with her strong work ethic, even after he reminded her she was not being paid by the hour. She showed instant talent for summarising briefs of evidence and identifying the best witnesses for a client's defence. Her research skills were brilliant. Another lawyer likened them to reading an entire phone book and finding the two or three numbers that mattered. Soon, she was managing minor criminal courtroom matters, such as motion hearings, without Diamond's direct supervision. She would strike out on her own as a barrister in 12 months' time. Until she passed the bar exam, she would remain a solicitor. The same eagerness to please, noted in her school report a decade earlier, underpinned her professional strengths. Through Diamond, Gobbo was able to forge connections with high-flying legal peers early in her career. She instructed cases as a solicitor to legendary barristers. She took inspiration from pioneering women who had become Queen's Counsel barristers, such as Lillian Leader, QC. She was impassioned and enthused, qualities already being noted by observers who assumed that she would ascend to become a Supreme Court judge. Gobbo was openly ambitious and thrilled by the variety of criminal cases Diamond dished out. Each day, she woke up wondering who she would meet and where she would go. She was exposed to police briefs of evidence against her clients for the first time. She prided herself on exposing their flaws of logic and the underlying faults of the police investigation. She learnt the difference between thorough and sloppy police work. Using the kind of language most would not expect to hear in the mouth of a solicitor, she called the officers responsible liars and cocksuckers. If she was getting to know lawyers and cops, she was getting to know Diamond's criminal clients too. Tony Mockbell sweet-talked female staff at Diamond's office and presented them with gift cards one Christmas. The beginnings of their association as lawyer and client were more vexed. She accompanied Tony Mockbell to court as a junior solicitor for a bail surety for his brother Horty. He stated that he solely owned a property, which he did not. He was charged with perjury, and Gobbo was called as a witness for the failed case against him. It was the start of a long and often fraught relationship. Nikki bristled with energy and vulnerability. Diamond had liked her immediately. He assumed the affection was reciprocated. At every office Christmas party, Gobbo beelined to Diamond for a dance. He sounds wistful many years later, like a parent discussing a prodigal daughter. The new employee's work was exemplary, but the rest of her life played out like a soap opera for the entertainment of her colleagues. She revved a little black sports car through the Richmond laneways behind Diamond's then office, slotted it into the tightest of spaces, and climbed out as if she was scaling a wall. She seldom turned up on time. She was often outside, fag dangling from her mouth. She was the court jester, never short of stories that began with, "You wouldn't believe." She was quirky, too. That big brain of hers sometimes entertained strange lines of thought. She once told colleagues she was concerned that her microwave was bugged by police because of a flashing red light. They were unsure how to receive this. Why would police bug a junior solicitor's home? Yet Diamond was beginning to fret. Lawyers traditionally kept a distance between themselves and their clients, lest their client relationships should get mistaken for friendships. But she seemed overly familiar with many of hers. Dangerous men, dangerous liaisons. At the same time, she drank with police and even slept with some of them. Gobbo was dropped off at work one morning in an unmarked police car. When Diamond left the office one evening, the same man in the same car was outside waiting for her. The man, who Diamond later learned was a senior Victoria police officer, shielded his face so as not to be seen. Diamond spoke to Gobbo about a bad look and crossed lines. He told her to avoid screwing cops and criminals. She would get burned, he explained, in avuncular advice steeped in long experience. Gobbo countered that she knew what she was doing. She used profanities that flushed Diamond's fleshy cheeks. More subtle were other traits. The wheedling. The disregard for rules. Diamond still shakes his head. He describes Gobbo with affection as immature, short-tempered, and irrational. She was a wild child. He could see all that, but he never understood the toll Gobbo's choices were taking on her. He never understood her visceral responses to police. They didn't make sense, given her romantic associations with police officers. He recalls how he once shook the hand of Wayne Strawhorn, a drug squad detective who, at the same time, was investigating Diamond with Gobbo's secret assistance. Gobbo spoke to Diamond afterwards of going to the bathroom to throw up. She deceived him, as she did everyone else. She was already falling into unwise relationships that strained both her professional and personal well-being. Knowing how she suffered for it doesn't make it any better. Diamond feels cheated by his misjudgments, disarmed of his instincts. "I thought I knew her, but I didn't," he says. Nicola Gobbo had tried and failed as a police informer almost 3 years earlier. Now she was secretly presenting herself for another stint. She was trying to jail her boss. According to her, he was laundering money. Detectives from Gobbo's second informing period speak of her eagerness to jail Diamond. She urged police to check certain properties and analyze a trust account. They argue they were led by the hand of an agent provocateur. They say they applied no pressure. She recalled it differently in her diary from the time. In her version, which carries some weight as a contemporaneous and private account, she wasn't a scorpion, but a cornered chicken. In childlike loops, she wrote about a mid-1998 meeting with two detectives. They told her that her name was on incriminating tapes. Exactly what was on the tapes that implicated her remains a mystery. One diary entry rings with authenticity. "Mud sticks. Get a raincoat soon," Gobbo wrote that detectives told her. The raincoat was an offer of protection. She could shield herself from prosecution if she assisted the investigation into her boss. One of those detectives was Senior Sergeant Wayne Strawhorn, a feared drug buster within Victoria Police. Gobbo regarded him as all-powerful and intimidating. He contacted her in 1998 because he believed Diamond was laundering money for client John Higgs. Gobbo would claim in 2020 that she felt Strawhorn manipulated her by taking advantage of her perceived proximity to her boss. Diamond has always denied the allegations and has never been charged with any offence. Diamond annoyed detectives. As Gobbo would later, he had cornered the market for representing suspected drug traffickers. He was often the lawyer for most or all of the suspects charged in major drug raids at the time. Gobbo and Strawhorn met repeatedly at a South Melbourne coffee shop. He grilled her for information, and she went along with the questioning. Yet Gobbo would later assert that she told Diamond about Strawhorn's suspicions against him. According to Diamond, he sent Strawhorn a fax demanding that he leave Gobbo alone. In isolation, her words seem plausible. Strawhorn was undoubtedly a boogeyman obsessed with fighting crime. He might have coerced Gobbo's cooperation, but her claim to compulsion gets muddied by separate but related facts. A month or so before the purported offer of a police raincoat, Gobbo rang the Australian Federal Police. She asked about the AFP's recruiting policies. Two AFP officers met her the following day, the 14th of May 1998. In keeping with Gobbo's propensity to blend the social and professional, the 7 p.m. office meeting moved on to the Celtic Club pub and concluded at about midnight. According to the officers, Gobbo raised issues of morality and ethics relating to police and lawyers. She stated that she believed her home was bugged by police. She wanted to talk about a tax evasion charge against Horty Mockbell that would later lead to that first unusual encounter with Brother Tony. Horty would end up beating the charges. She also offered information about a conspiracy to defraud case against a wealthy Jewish family. The AFP officers concluded Gobbo had no information of substance. They dismissed her as untrustworthy. Yet Gobbo kept calling them. She kept offering herself up as a police informer because she could not cope, as she put it, with the ethical issues of her circumstances. She was drastically uncomfortable with what she perceived was the wrongdoing around her. Just as she had as a third-year law student, Gobbo was again seeking to inform and trash the ethics of her profession 6 months before she was admitted to the bar as a barrister, and at a time when she was being held up in public as a promising light of legal excellence. Strawhorn was the first of four Svengali-like detectives in her longer period of assisting police, whom she named in 2020. She would say Strawhorn took advantage of her naivete and paranoia. So much for her claims of maturity the year before in her application to be accepted as a lawyer. Her relationship with Strawhorn started a pattern she later spoke about to her psychologist. She felt these detectives used her to fish for jigsaw pieces in investigations. She sought to please them at the time, not realizing the extent to which she was being used. And as pathetic as that sounds for me to admit, I think that's the best way to put it, she would say in 2020. She sounded enthused at one meeting with detectives 5 months after the raincoat meeting, suggesting four avenues of investigation for them to pursue. But one officer was not impressed. Detective Senior Constable Chris Lim expressed concerns similar to those of Detective Senior Sergeant Jack Blaney 3 years earlier. Lim felt Gobbo was too overt in her desire to provide information. She was known to have had inappropriate relationships with police officers and, according to one police report, to be in possession of drugs belonging to a client. This was 5 years after she was caught in possession of hard drugs at her Carlton home, and a few months after she was accepted as a barrister. And yet she was on the police radar for carrying drugs? Lim dismissed her as unsuited to police informing. Yet his opinion, like those of Blaney in 1995 and the AFP officers she had met with more recently, seemed to be ignored. Gobbo spoke to drug squad officers throughout much of 1998. Strawhorn was present at a meeting the following May at the Emerald Hotel in South Melbourne. Jeff Pope, a young detective from the Asset Recovery Squad, part of the Major Fraud Squad, came along too. The group discussed the criminal allegations against Diamond. The Emerald was known for quality pub grub in the emerging dining market of the era. At this hub of horse racing figures, Gobbo had a regular courtyard table where she could smoke. The next day, Pope applied to register Gobbo as a human source. It appears that he was unaware of Gobbo's previous informing in 1995, though Gobbo herself says she did not know that until almost 25 years later. No concerns about a potential conflict with the ethical demands of her profession were noted on the application. Once informer G395, Gobbo was now informer MFG13. As Pope would reveal in 2019, he spoke to Gobbo every day for the first 2 weeks of June 1999. Their chatter extended to football, politics, and the police. Then, as now, Gobbo voiced strong views on many matters. There was a four-hour get-together in the inner Melbourne suburb of Armidale, at which she promised to provide incriminating computer disks to substantiate the criminal claims against her boss. She offered to chat with a client of Diamond's suspected of involvement in the alleged money laundering. She also pushed the boundaries of the relationship. She asked Pope to help vary a restraining order for one of her other clients. She also sent him notes for his law degree studies. Yet by November 1999, Gobbo's informer role had fizzled. Pope dismissed her information as of no value, and she was deactivated. Diamond was no longer to be investigated. Naturally, Diamond argues there was nothing to investigate. It would be another 16 years before he learned that she had assisted in a criminal investigation against him. Pope, by his account, received a call from Gobbo in 2000 after an odd drug raid in Abbotsford. The property contained no drugs, cash, or drug paraphernalia. Gobbo told Pope that he didn't know what he had stumbled into. How did she know that Pope had attended the property? She was just 27, not long out of university, but she was already omnipotent, an outsider on the inside. Pope had an unplanned meeting with Gobbo in 2000. They ran into each other at court and went for coffee at the nearby Metropolitan Hotel. Gobbo was getting ahead, she told Pope. She was about to go on a holiday to Hawaii, but she would pay for the right companion to come along. Pope declined the purported offer, which Gobbo contends was never put to him. Whether his or her version is accurate is a matter of guesswork. At the end of our conversation, she asked whether our relationship was ever likely to develop into something more meaningful. Pope would say in 2019, I said no, as I was happily married. As I recall, that was the end of the conversation. Gobbo was indeed getting ahead by this stage. In early 1999, just before the escalating gangland feud exploded into bloody life, Gobbo was being toasted in the news pages of the Herald Sun. At 26, she was admitted as one of the youngest female barristers in Victoria's history. Gobbo was poised to perpetuate family pride. She seemed to emulate Leda, who, along with Betty King QC, later to become the gangland judge, was one of the first women to take silk in Victoria. Gobbo stood as an emblem of a changing world, one that was finally giving women overdue recognition. She was a role model, As she had fated leader, would younger female lawyers thank Nicola Gobbo for blazing a path? Diamond's favourite ex-employee was now a barrister he briefed for criminal clients. As a solicitor, she had learned the grunt work of painstaking research and paper trails. Now she could appear in court, cross-examining witnesses and excoriating the police officers she had privately railed against. Barristers are generally precluded from working in partnership with other barristers or solicitors. They work from chambers shared with other independent barristers. Yet Gobbo had a ready list of prospective clients after only a year of working under Diamond. His. She was fearless, on the fast track. Gone was the little black car she had driven to Diamond's office. Now she drove a luxury sports vehicle. Fast. She wore miniskirts. She embraced the trappings of her lucrative line of work. Wheat Restaurant and Bar in Lonsdale Street, in the heart of Melbourne's legal district, became a second office for Gobbo. She smoked on the balcony there with a phone permanently attached to her ear. She also gravitated to South Melbourne pubs, like the Emerald, that took food and prices seriously, and to Melbourne's best Italian restaurants in Carlton and Fitzroy, which had gifted the metropolis its preoccupation with gastronomy and wine. Gobbo was the master of the drop-in drink, perhaps at Mint, which buzzed with lawyers on Friday afternoons, or across William Street at the Metropolitan. She represented major drug criminals because they could afford her. She chased their business and socialised with them regularly. The young woman who preferred to wear Chanel's Allure or Calvin Klein's Eternity was roughly earning about $250,000 a year. Criminal lawyers of Gobbo's ilk are enveloped by the depraved and the disturbed. The terms of engagement are well understood. The scruffy delinquents who materialise at their wood-panelled offices are usually guilty of the criminal charges against them. A criminal trial is not simply a test of guilt or otherwise. The onus is entirely on the prosecution, usually the police and the Office of Public Prosecutions, to prove guilt beyond reasonable doubt. Defence barristers like Gobbo seek to expose holes of logic or fact in the police cases against their clients. By the time of her chance meeting with Pope in 2000, Nicola Gobbo's freakiest clients were drawing journalists to the courtroom. Gobbo defended a bird breeder who smuggled parrot eggs in his underpants. For a drunk driver, Gobbo argued that her client thought he had been drinking light beer. For a pensioner busted with 1,100 marijuana plants in his backyard, she claimed the man had sprinkled seeds from a jar he'd found in the garage. Gobbo told a court that a woman who helped her paralysed partner commit a sexual assault deserved compassion because she'd lost babies soon after giving birth. A client in an international prostitution scheme was a dupe. Gobbo's legal wrangling in this case repelled another barrister involved, Sharon Cure, who wondered at Gobbo's ethics at the time. Gobbo and Cure would clash in the years ahead. Gobbo came to be feared by police officers whom she cross-examined. She might have socialised with them outside the courtroom, but inside she projected contempt for them. Renowned homicide detective Charlie Bezina never questioned her ability. She was good on her feet, was how Bezina would describe her courtroom style to the authors in 2018. Detective Sergeant Paul Dale of the Major Drug Investigation Division, soon to be a controversial figure, was similarly impressed by Gobbo's outward professionalism. She was Amazonian, he would say in his 2013 book Disgraced. Long blonde hair, short skirts, short tops, with plenty of breast showing. Gobbo was an excellent lawyer in part because she excelled in studying human nature. I think she loved the limelight that came with dealing with both the major criminals and detectives who caught them, Dale would observe. Outside the courtroom, though, things were trickier. Her name in police and legal circles differed from her public profile as a thrusting female lawyer. Her path was already marked by unorthodoxy, and her reputation was suffering. Melbourne may be a thriving metropolis of European-style elegance, but it can also be mistaken for a village of a few million people. Colder than the northern states, more buttoned up, Melbourne is the preserve of the quiet word. Real power is mostly hidden, wielded by few and dispensed with a nod or a whisper. Inspired by the likes of Betty King, Gobbo harboured thoughts of becoming a judge, but her choices from the start of her career had precluded her from judicial promotion. The story goes that two magistrates advised Gobbo her criminal associations risked costing her a future appointment to the bench. Her profile was rising, but so was the whiff of wrongness about her. She was thought to be too close to her clients. As a former judge now puts it, she was dismissed, mistakenly, as a gangster's mole. Colleagues later disdained Gobbo's pretensions of a seat on the bench. She didn't work hard enough, one would tell the authors. The law is more than coffees, phone calls, and exchanges of gossip. Not many of her fellow barristers have kind words to say about Gobbo. Her radioactive aura, says a female colleague, was coupled with a generous use of fake tan. Many women avoided her. A journalist recalls her at the bar of the Celtic Club, where the carpet clung to the soles of your shoes. She was alone, shouting drinks, and clearly desperate, like a lonely girl at the school prom. Dale remembers seeing Gobbo at a Christmas party in another city bar. She was very drunk, very loud, and the centre of attention. This appeared to be her personality at the time, larger than life. She was like that at police social gatherings, as well as when in her own environment. A politically incorrect underworld source from the time says, "What caught my eye was the way she dressed and the way she presented herself. She was cheap and easy. I thought there was more than meets the eye, and she thought she was untouchable because of her blue blood family." Yet her uncle, Sir James, heard the rumours. Gobbo was spotted in the street, crying uncontrollably, after an annual blessing for the legal fraternity called Red Mass at Melbourne St Patrick Cathedral in the early 2000s. One of Australia's finest barristers stopped his car and offered her a lift. She told him that Sir James had turned his back on her at the event. It mattered. For the past decade, Nicola Gobbo had name-dropped her uncle at every opportunity. Such moments of humiliation were the price for the life she had chosen. Her networking with undesirables and fraternising with police had cast her as unseemly. But Sir James knew little of the deeper truth. No one did. An episode tracing to gangland's earliest rumblings offers insight into the double life she was leading by this point. Detective Senior Constable Stephen Campbell was one of four officers on an operation at the St Kilda Marina in 1999, who were later charged for trafficking marijuana. The story went that the officers were tipped off about a drug deal by the man who was picking up the drugs. The officers were later accused of having stolen the 13 kilograms of marijuana before the deal was done. The crook who tipped them off can't be named, but let's call him Pistol Pete. He was also charged over the drugs and later convicted. He made a statement implicating the four officers and became a key witness in the unsuccessful prosecution against them. Nicola Gobbo represented Pistol Pete. But she also slept with Campbell over two distinct periods, around 1999 and 2001. By the time the case went to court in 2005, Campbell and Gobbo were still friends. He and his fellow officers would be found not guilty, after Pistol Pete reneged on his statement. He had no idea that his lawyer was close to Campbell throughout this time. He said in 2019 that he would have sacked her on the spot if he had. Pistol Pete had assumed that his lawyer was working in his best interests. He later declared that Gobbo gave a whole new meaning to barristers dicking police. Most lawyers don't act this way. For them, controversy is contained to their clients. The legal system is a fluid beast. Its fundamentals were developed over centuries, but, like language, It is always evolving. Lawyers can be expected to push boundaries in pursuit of their cause, but there is no latitude for them to behave outside the rules. They are policed by ethics boards, and they become scholars in what they can and cannot do. Protections are enshrined in the system. If you are charged with a crime, you consult with a solicitor. If the case is serious enough to go to court, the solicitor will brief a barrister, such as Gobbo, to represent you. They cannot take your case if they are conflicted. Say, if they represent another client whose best interests do not match yours. A 2000 case in Queensland, known as the Queen versus Michael Carl Szabo, depicts the rigours of the profession. In Szabo, a defence lawyer did not disclose to his client his recent romantic relationship with the prosecutor, which resumed shortly after the trial. When it was revealed, the guilty verdict was set aside and another trial was ordered, even though the defence lawyer was thought to have presented a competent case for his client. Criminal barristers play an adversarial role aimed at identifying flaws in the case against you. They cross-examine police officers and other witnesses. They also seek to subpoena unpresented documents that may help your defence. Sometimes, when the prosecution case is very strong, your barrister may advise you to plead guilty to some charges to reduce your overall sentence. Typically, the prosecution files as many charges as it can identify, then a plea bargaining process begins. In exchange for pleading guilty to some charges, thereby expediting the justice process, the prosecution may drop other charges. This process is bamboozling to the average defendant, who is generally reliant on the advice of their barrister. It helps explain why many defence barristers wheel whole suitcases filled with documents to and from courtrooms. They are fighting battles on behalf of you, the client, that you often cannot fathom. You're entitled to speak to your solicitor and barrister in confidence. The conversations are shielded by legal professional privilege. They cannot be monitored by police. Apart from a few narrow exceptions, your lawyer cannot repeat incriminating information about you to anyone. He or she is ethically bound to provide independent advice that is in your best interests. For the system to work, you must trust in your lawyer's unfettered representation of you. These are the general rules that explain why Gobbo's choices would repulse the entire legal fraternity. The Law Institute of Victoria's Professional Conduct and Practice Rule 1.1 states, "A practitioner must, in the course of engaging in legal practice, act honestly and fairly in clients' best interests and maintain clients' confidences." Sounds simple enough. Four things: honesty, fairness, client welfare, and confidentiality. But Gobbo must have missed the memo. She did not provide independent advice. She did not uphold the confidentiality of her arrested clients. She did not even act as a barrister should, leaving the everyday work to the solicitors who briefed her. She turned up at police stations after her clients were arrested, a proximity that is a solicitor's domain. Her fingerprints smudged every aspect of her clients' cases, and each time she put police interests ahead of theirs, she was in breach of her sworn duties to both her clients and the court. Pistol Pete's account offered only an inkling of Gobbo's bigger deceptions. Around the time he was caught with 13 kilograms of marijuana, Gobbo had already graduated to become a confidant to the underworld's biggest names. Melbourne's gangland war was triggered when three punks met in a nothing park, and one punk shot another punk in the guts.